Sorry.
That was a fantastic morning, and I don't know about you, but I know it's a fantastic morning. I do know about you. One of the characteristics of a really good conference is that when there's a break, there's sort of like this cacophony of conversations, of people talking and debating and all these sorts of things about what was going on. So thank you all the presenters for this morning. Thank you for the chairs, who's actually there. As many of you are aware, there's actually been an explosion in one of the tube stations, and I just want to say their thoughts for people who are affected and impacted by that. We don't know very much. It's only been 15, 20 minutes ago that the news came through. The second keynote, Dr. Alan McCulley, is recently retired from the University of Ulster, where he was a senior lecturer for over 20 years. Born in Belfast, Alan has gone through that transformation of Northern Ireland over the 1950s and 60s and right up to today, and being integral as a teacher and a researcher and a teacher educator in engaging how young people make sense of controversial and difficult and traumatic aspects of post-conflict societies. Within the world of history education and teaching and learning, Alan is something of a legend. His work is widely cited. It is drawn upon closely by researchers and by people like myself as teacher educators in looking at how young people actually make sense and make meaning of difficult, traumatic events of the past. And Alan, you're, as a scholar and as a teacher, you've made an enormous contribution to that field. Recently, Alan was working with the UNESCO Education for Peace and Building in a four-country study in Nama, Pakistan, South Africa and Uganda that looked very much at that nature of how this education policy can promote understanding of a traumatic past, and particularly how that, what that contribution that actually makes to reconciliation. But I think that the core contribution that Alan's work has made, and why people like Alison and I cite it so often and use it, is the way that he draws upon student voice and young people's voice, and the way that his work has very much, from a and what it said to us from a methodological point of view, is how you actually engage finding an authentic way of how young people make meaning of the past and particular sorts of events. So Alan, looking forward to what you have to say, and thank you very much for coming and talking to us today.
Thank you. I don't know if you've ever nonchalantly handed a title to the organisers of things like this, and then you write what you're going to say, and then you look at what you've written and what the title was, and you realise there's a gap. So I think somewhere in there I would have put from research to practice. A few reservations about doing this. One is that the data that I'm going to draw on is now at least 10 years old. The whole thing is very Northern Ireland focused. And so what I've tried to do is to try to place that research in the contemporary context of the decade of centenaries in Ireland, to draw out briefly some of the data of ours that specifically related to the wars. And then I want to show some practical application in the classroom. So although the data is 10, 12 years old, it's come through a changing time in Irish and Northern Irish history. And in the spirit of impact, what I and a teaching colleague have tried to do is apply some of the learning from the research. In other words, to put our money where our mouth is and actually address the sorts of things we find in the way we approach things in the classroom. Okay, well, maybe something about the decade of centenaries. People have talked about the centenary of the war, but in the Irish context, that's only one event in a series of very, very important anniversaries which have shaped modern Ireland, all leading up to the partition of the island. Two very obvious ones, Battle of the Somme and the Easter Rising. And I suppose the great fear of the decade of centenaries was that these events were going to be exclusive. It was going to be the same old, ours and theirs. And some of that has been the case. Certainly it kicked off with the Ulster Covenant in 2012, and it was very much, we'll go up to Stormont and our bands will play and we'll fly our flags and you lot just stay indoors. And then we'll say afterwards, wasn't it a great day because there was no violence? I think the decade has moved on from that. In the south, this decade has been promoted by the state in commemoration. That wasn't possible. We couldn't reach any sort of political agreement in the north. But consequently, civil society has taken a really big role in it. And while it has been piecemeal and there's been events, maybe to some extent these two, which have been fairly exclusive to the respective communities. Nevertheless, I think civil society has done a huge job in trying to open these events up to new imaginings and to debate and discussion. And I think no more so than the war itself. I think the meeting of Mary McAleese and Queen Elizabeth was a very important backdrop to this. And maybe 20 years after the Good Friday Agreement, many families on the nationalist side have re-engaged with their war histories, and the recognition that many families contributed to what happened in the trenches as well as what happened subsequently in the nationalist struggle. So, teaching history in a contested society. Three big challenges, I think. And one is that a national narrative is out of the question, because there are at least two, and I would argue many more. It's a situation where the past is used almost constantly, not for itself, but to justify contemporary political positions. Many people aren't really interested in the past. They're interested in how they can use the past to further their own contemporary political position. And obviously, it's a situation where events of the past are deeply felt and are sometimes regarded as sacrosanct, and where selective stories are transmitted through family and community. So that when kids come into school, they may be carrying many ideas about the past. There may be a great deal of substance to that narrative, but there may well be gaps, and there may well be misconceptions. So, Keith Barton from Indiana University and myself wanted to investigate this interface between history that's learned in school and history that's learned in the community. And we started off with James Wirch's idea of narrative schematic templates. Now, the idea that we all have a sort of loose frame. We don't have to know the details of a narrative. It's just that framing. And then anything that we encounter, we're likely to bring into that frame and equate it with the existing narrative that we have building up. And Wirch also talks about this idea of appropriation and resistance, that when there is a dominant narrative, those whose frame fits that narrative will appropriate it. Those whose frame does not fit that narrative will resist it. And his work was done in the Baltic states under the Soviet Union and the Baltic state resistance to that Soviet narrative. That's where we started. I think this, as we worked through the project, we began to realise that in our context, in a conflicted society, something different was happening. It was much more complex. And we started to draw on Bakhtin's idea of internally persuasive discourse. In other words, kids were learning their history from very many sources, some formal, some informal. And they weren't necessarily prioritizing the source, although they greatly valued school history. But what they were trying to do really was make sense of all these versions of the past that were coming into their head. And they were trying to do it for themselves and make sense of what was going on. Two things really interested us. One was how history impacted on young people and children's sense of national identity. And we were interested in how they negotiated the community and the street history and how the school history fitted in or didn't fit in with what they were learning in communities. Very quickly, the study was in 11 schools. We interviewed children in pairs. You know, it's interesting that comment about individual interviews today. By interviewing in pairs, we felt that the kids would talk to each other and that the role of the interviewer and that power imbalance would be somewhat removed. The key to the interviews was the sorting task. The sorting task was based on a number of images. Those images were drawn from curriculum, were drawn from community, were drawn from local history, and even some from international history. Thereby, we wanted images that both would reference what they had learned in school, but also images that would connect with things that they might encounter in communities. We then asked them questions like, which picture or pictures are more important to you? And then, which pictures are more important in history? And often the answers to those two questions were different. So we had about five questions in all. Obviously, I'm flying through this, but in terms of our findings, kids were not accepting any of the history they encountered uncritically. They were questioning. However, they did value school history. School history was, quote, where you hear both sides. School history is teaches you balance. School history offers you other points of view. And I think in the context of a history curriculum that at least purports to follow an inquiry approach and offers multiple perspectives, I think this was encouraging. But kids were also aware that history was used for contemporary purposes and that they would often encounter history that was potentially manipulating. The internally persuasive discourse, then, was the process by which they used to make sense. I'll come back to that slide. We conclude that what was going on, kids were engaging in multiple sources of historical information. Students navigated amongst these in a conscious attempt to refine and extend their historical understanding. Sometimes this led them to assimilate new knowledge with their existing narrative. At other times, it opened it up to new lines of inquiry. But there were limitations. We found, for example, that as kids moved up from year 8, year 9, and year 10, and in our terms, that's the ages 11 to 14, that was the group that we surveyed, that they were more likely to draw on selective histories in order, or draw selectively on the history that they were learning in order to support their emerging politicization. Okay, so year 8, you know, they were more open. By year 10, they would see a picture of Edward Carson and the Union flag, and they were more likely to say, that's Carson, I identify with him, and they were able to bring in their school history in order to justify their choice. And also, while it was clear that they were open to challenge and they wanted to be challenged, when it came down to it, it was actually very difficult for many kids to move beyond their community perspectives. And that's not surprising, nor is it necessarily something that we were trying to do or should be trying to do as history teachers. They were frustrated at the failure to explain the recent past to them. So there seemed to be a sort of gap between the partition, 1922, and the troubles of the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. They knew the troubles had occurred, but they really craved to know why. And they tended to have quite simplistic ideas on what the conflict was about. Very often, for example, using the term religion, because they were used to the Protestant-Catholic divide, rather than thinking of it in terms of cultural and national identities and conflicting identities. Another thing we found was that, and I think this is where we have done kids a disservice over 30 years, they tended to talk in dual perspectives. The unionist position, the nationalist position. And that seemed to give them a sense of insolubility of the problem. You know, two monolithic blocks opposing each other. And none of the nuances and the complexities and the continuum of views that existed in the past and continue to exist in the present. We concluded that maybe the inquiry approach, which puts such emphasis on evidence and argument, was to some extent failing to deal with the more affective dimensions of learning. Many of these issues that kids were encountering had emotional resonance for them. And unless we as educators deal with that emotional dimension, then the cognitive is liable to leave them pretty dry. You know, how do we help them to work through those emotional factors, which then allows the cognitive stuff to kick in? We also concluded that much of the history that they were learning was too contained in the past, that not enough connections were being made by the history that they were learning in school and the contemporary situation. As has been said a couple of times this morning, you know, our young people seem to want to have the present explained to them, and being taught the past in the past wasn't making the connections that they felt were necessary. And that can be put down to some extent, I think, to teacher avoidance. You know, I'm happy to teach about 1916, back in 1916, but don't ask me to make the connections between 1916 and the modern provisional movement. Also, I think that there was an issue that maybe the rhetoric of inquiry-based multi-perspectivity that teachers taught wasn't always evident in their practice. And Alison has written a little bit about this in the Northern Ireland context. Okay, how did this play out in learning about the wars? Sources. Well, the family was a very important dimension to this. Artifacts were involved. But there was also TV, museums, and wall murals in their own communities. Why were the World Wars important? Again, sometimes it was personal reasons. Like they went to war back then, and it wasn't easy for the people that was left. Because like my great-granddad went out, and my great-granny there, was news coming nearly every day that great-granddad was going to die. But there was also the sacrifice and freedom narrative, very strong. It was important to win. All might be different. We might not be here today. We wouldn't be talking English. It's important to appreciate what the people who fought in the war did for you, because lots of them died so that we can be free now. Maybe the war's important because a lot of people died in it, and it's important for people who, like women, who lost their husbands and stuff, and it brings back memories, and it would be most important to them, and maybe important to other people. There's also another slightly more disturbing frame coming through. Wars help solve problems and things like that, because the future all depends on war. There was a sense that not only was war inevitable, but war, the consequences of war, had moved society on, which I think is interesting in a society which has encountered a lot of violence. When we ask kids to identify what was important to them, three main clusters came up. The most popular cluster was the Troubles, but not in a partisan sense. Identification with the Troubles because we live with it, we have to put up with it, it's part of who we are. The second group were those who did identify with their own communities, with a partisan history. Those pictures because they're part of what I am as a young loyalist or a young nationalist. And the third most popular identification was with wars. And that, maybe surprisingly, crossed both communities. Yes, it was more prevalent amongst kids from Protestant schools, but there were many kids from nationalist schools too, who identified with the wars. And it seemed to be that they were making a distinction between the British Army that perhaps they and certainly their parents had encountered in their own community and the army that fought in the world wars. I think that's an interesting distinction. And I suspect that distinction maybe has developed over the last decade. Of course, there were those who recognised that the war itself can be used for particular purposes, and that they identified with the war and their own communities in a very narrow sense. The UVF and the First World War and the Battle of the Boyne, learned from parents really. Or my cousin Alistair, who was a wall muralist, he taught me my history about the Battle of the Somme. Or up in a White House in Glencairn, a little community museum, they, the soldiers, stayed in a big field and they went up to the Union Jack table and signed up. And then a couple of years later, they went out and fought in the war, sort of conflating opposition to Home Rule and the setting up of the UVF with the 36th Ulster Division going to war. And this narrative, World War I, we were fighting against the world, defending the world for Great Britain, and then the Troubles were fighting for Northern Ireland. You know, equating to different struggles, the local and the national, as one narrative. There was also a recognition even amongst young Protestants, that there was another side to this, that nationalists had participated in the war. The Irish didn't want to recognise that all the Irish soldiers died. So technically, it was the Protestant community, even though the Irish soldiers died in it. So they were separated. But that awareness that the nationalist community was struggling to recognise and represent its war dead. I would like to see more of the heritage of what the two religions have done, gone forward, the good stuff. And we should remember those great men that died for us in the war, because there's some Catholics now wouldn't even wear a poppy because they say the British government forced them to go out. They never did. They had a choice. So a certain resentment in a way that nationalists weren't recognising their contribution to the war. And one kid who simply said about representations of wall murals, it's not to do with history, it's to do with the paramilitary. Okay, so four conclusions to the research, in summary. Students recognised the difference between school and community history. Students appreciated the chance to learn about other perspectives in school. Students were grappling deeply with differing perspectives, but it was difficult to move beyond their community frameworks. And students did not often move past this idea of two communities and two histories. Okay, so trying to bring all that together, what does it mean for teaching history in contested societies? Well, I've come up with a set of principles which have recently been incorporated into a European cost document on teaching contested history. School history should challenge entrenched and unsubstantiated positions. It should myth bust and expose the abuse of history. School history should be about complexity, interpretation, and debate. For example, it should be looking for alternative stories. It should be looking for those who behave differently from their dominant community, who moved their own way, took their own decisions. Maybe maverick, but nevertheless, challenging the idea of monoliths and recognising that there is human agency and that within all positions there are different it's a continuum rather than two monoliths. Metacognition. Encouraging kids to recognize, I think this is very poignant given what we've been talking about this morning. Encouraging kids to recognize that their own backgrounds, their own biographies, may influence the way in which they see the past. Finding strategies to teach that so that they begin to realise that as others may have been influenced, so I need to question myself. And of course that's as true of teachers as it is of students. History needs to be, in these situations particularly, I would argue, a constant dialogue between past and present. Not bolted on in the last 5 minutes before the bell goes. But we should be teaching history in a way where we're moving fluently and flexibly between past and present. It should give them opportunities to explore the relationship between the history they learn and their national identity. And they should have an opportunity to listen to personal accounts. Oral history. And we've already grasped this morning the potency of hearing a genuine story well told, even when that story maybe comes from a perspective from which you're not familiar. But having said all that, I would still argue that there's so far that the discipline of history should go, and then it should hand over to others to carry through contemporary debate. And that's why I would argue for a much stronger relationship between history education and citizenship education, and an awareness in both camps, where the connections are. I'm not suggesting there's a thick black line, there isn't, but I do think there's, in the last 5 or 6 years, I've become uncomfortable with some of our history teaching moving beyond the discipline to deal with what I would regard anachronisms. Okay, so very quickly, putting all this, putting my money where my mouth was, I got a grant from the Community Relations Council in Northern Ireland to design a pack of materials, online materials, that would help kids to work through the decade of centenaries. There's one on the First World War. Sorry, there's one on the Home Rule Crisis. One on the First World War period, which combines the history of the war with the nationalist struggle and the rising, so dealing with those as contemporary events. There's one on commemoration, sorry, one on post-war troubles, which I think is the strongest and the most controversial. One on myth-busting, and one on commemoration. But I wanted very quickly look at the war one. And some of the questions, some of the inquiry questions that we're asking kids to address. We start that module by looking at an event in 2002 when Alex Maskey, Sinn Féin Mayor, decided for the first time to commemorate the Battle of the Somme. He did so, as you can see, with a green wreath, and he did so not on the day of remembrance, but a couple of days before. And it was a very important event and a controversial event. I'll come back to commemoration. We look at the outbreak of war. How did Belfast react when war broke out? The common experience. But also tales of the unexpected. Police reports, Belfast, September 1914. It is reported that during a football match at Belfast on the 19th of September, a Union Jack was flying on the chief flagstaff of the Celtic football grounds, which are owned and controlled by nationalists. A nationalist band, at the conclusion of the match, played the national anthem, God Save the King. It was Joe Devlin, nationalist leader, recruiting for the volunteers to go to war. But around the same time, at St. Michael's Church of Ireland Church on the 27th of September, one half of the congregation left while the national anthem was being played on the organ. Very few of those who remained joined in the singing. Since the passing of the Home Rule Bill, which went through Parliament in September 1914, the audience at the West End Picture House, Shankill Road, Loyalist area, have groaned and hissed when the King's photograph was displayed. So it's those little gems of when people behaved unexpectedly or behaved differently that I think we don't overplay them, but kids should be aware that particular circumstances bring particular reactions. Okay, very quickly to finish. Looking at families from the nationalist community who suffered during the war with casualties. This is the story of Elizabeth Adams. Both her brothers enlisted and were killed. Her fiancé was killed in the war, and eventually she married her fiancé's brother. In-depth investigation, what is worth remembering about the Battle of the Somme? Challenging that loyalist, sacrificial narrative. Getting them to think about what about that battle is important. Or, the nationalist side of things. Why has the nationalist contribution to the Battle of the Somme received less attention? Is that because the nationalist community retreated from it? Or is that because in Northern Ireland the nationalist community contribution was not recognised? Messines, in 1917, where the Ulster Division and the 16th Irish fought more side by side than they did in the song. There were connections between them in battle. And at the end of that, getting the kids to think of some sort of commemoration or monument. How should the scene be remembered today? And given that they have already lived through the commemoration of Messines a few weeks ago, getting them to compare what they design to the way that things were represented. And finally, asking a pretty challenging question. Those who died for Ireland, lest we forget, but not simply those who died in the rising, but those who died at the front. Who would have claimed also to be dying for Ireland, to demonstrate Ireland's right to an independent nation. Okay, so I think I would love to, if I had the energy, to conduct a research project post the decade of centenaries, and really examine what sort of impact 20, 30 years after the Good Friday Agreement, well, it'll be 20 next year, 20 years after the Good Friday Agreement, but having worked our way through these commemorations, how far young people's attitudes have moved on. Thank you.
We've got about 2 minutes for questions. I think that was a wonderful case study on the complex nature of commemoration of war that Northern Ireland makes. But all memory of war is complex, whether we know it or not, whether we accept it or not. So about 10 minutes for questions. Comments? Thoughts?
I think you would find some changes in the last 10 years. You'll know, but I'll have to explain for other people that I've been working on Ireland and the First World War for the past 15 years or so, and we've had conversations about that. And despite coming from a County Armagh Unionist family, despite the accent, my work's quite challenging to Unionists. And I've spent a lot of time during the decade of commemoration speaking both to Republican audiences and Unionist stroke Loyalist, and less so to broadly nationalist ones, actually, and also to some mixed audiences. And the most tricky ones are the loyalist audiences. But just reflecting on those meetings, I was struck by what you had to say about, right at the start, the theory about appropriation or resistance. What I actually find is with those loyalist communities is somewhere something more in the middle, which is that I turn up and offer a revisionist history, which suggests that things are, in very simple terms, much more complicated, lots more examples of Protestants and Catholics serving side by side beyond the 36th and 16th divisions. And that's resulted in a lot of people going away and doing research that I've worked with. It involved a lot of people in the loyalist community becoming very good historians and understanding the history, and yet the only thing they still want to go out and commemorate is the song of the war. Not even interested in commemorating Messines. Passchendaele goes by the by, and to make the point that there were lots of UVF men at Gallipoli, UVF men in the regulars, including members of my own family, they don't want to put that on walls. Now, we have, there's one exception to that in the Donegal Road, and we've got a, I think a five mural project going up looking at different aspects of the war. I think the first three have gone up now. But there's this odd, I just have this odd sort of feeling when I come away from a meeting. Thank you very much, that was very interesting. We're not going out marching about it, though. So that just supports the point that a lot of this so-called history is not history at all. Yeah. It's about the paramilitaries and essentially giving the paramilitary something to do in what is still a very conflicted society.
Yeah, and that would fit with our kids who find it so hard to move beyond, even though they haven't had this. Yeah.
Any other comment?
I just have a question about developing the pack. You said earlier that you felt that some of your survey results were about teachers being a bit nervous of going into complementary territory, and and whether you'd had some responses to, in a way, making them do that with your resource pack.
Well, throughout my career, I've been encouraging teachers to stick their heads above. It's a minority of who do. But I've become quite frustrated in a way at teachers using the excuse, but we don't know how to do it. I'm convinced it's not about knowing how to do it. It's about jumping off the edge of the pool into the water. Because the skills involved in this are the skills of good teaching. What makes it more difficult is the content and the possible reactions. But good teachers, I think, can handle that. And one of the difficulties is modelling. Because you meet teachers in service work, and you can work with them, but they don't see it in practice in classrooms. And therefore, suggests to me there's a big leap between engaging in in-service work and looking at the material and looking at the methodology and actually going in there and doing it. And classrooms are very isolated places. Now, I find with youth workers, this sort of stuff can work much more easily because they work in pairs, they work less formally, and they model it, and they just go, you do it now. All right, and they do it. Classrooms are more isolated places, I think. And perhaps more wary of potential reactions.
Okay, one more question.
If no one else has got... I've come across a practical constraint of trying to work with schools in Northern Ireland as well, which is being very results conscious and aware of how much time there is. And with Queen's and the Living Legacy Centre, we identified a grammar school in the Falls that we thought we wanted to work with. The kids were really switched on. They knew why Andersonstown UVF was a strange concept, all this sort of thing. But at the end of the day, the teacher said, we can't do this in lesson time because we've got to focus on the curriculum. And their results are so high that they couldn't let anything slip.
I don't think that's just a Northern Ireland problem.
No, that's right.
Look, thank you, Alan. It was a really interesting, provocative, and talk that made us think a lot about the nature of war commemoration. Thank you very much.
Right, if we can move as quickly as possible. I know we've got a lot of people in this panel.